Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to a recording about immigration to the U.S. in the 19th century. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 9. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
In the middle of the 19th century, big railroad companies in the U.S. faced a bit of a problem. Congress had recently granted them millions of acres of public lands in the newly acquired Western Territories. But all that land didn't amount to much for the railroads without products to carry on their trains.
They needed people. They needed towns. They needed goods to transport and farmers to grow those products. They realized that they were going to have to import a brand new population. And so in the 1870s, they turned to Europeans, ideal candidates for relocation. European farmers and peasants were struggling at that very time under various forms of persecution, famine, and crushing rents.
And you're moving from that to somewhere where there suddenly is real hope and purposefulness.
This is Andy Piasecki, a student of public relations. He argues that the campaign to attract European settlers to America was one of the earliest examples of the kind of sophisticated corporate marketing efforts that we'd recognize today. Railroad companies established offices and vast networks of travel agents across Europe. They conducted a sort of market research to find out which groups would be the most likely to make the move. And Piasecki says the entire campaign was rooted in one basic message.
If you move out for the West, you become free and independent.
Across the European continent, railroad men visited agricultural fairs to distribute maps and pamphlets. Hired men masquerading as professors touted the idea that America was a farmer's paradise. Some of these so-called professors said a farmer could grow crops 9 months out of a year in America, or that Nebraska only had 1 month of winter. One even claimed that the speed of the railroads produced a magnetic effect that increased rainfall.
Nobody told them about the harshness of the climate. Nobody told them about the tornadoes. Nobody told them about the brutally tough winters. Nobody told them that in some parts of the prairie, the grass is so high that your children could actually get lost in the grass.
Now, it's not that the railroad companies were promising a walk in the park in the American West. In fact, some of them actually appealed to the Protestant work ethic of the Northern Europeans. And Piasecki found a great example of this in a publication that came from the Santa Fe Railroad.
If hard work doesn't agree with you, or you can't get on without luxuries, stay where you are. If you are susceptible to homesickness, if you do not have pluck and perseverance, stay where you are. Wealth here is won only by work.
In other words, it wasn't going to be easy.
But, you know, behind that, the message from the railroad companies is, but we're there to help you. We're there to help you in every way, if you're made of the right stuff.
In the end, the PR campaigns were a stunning success. During the 1870s and 1880s, nearly 4.5 million immigrants came to the Midwest. New settlers established almost 2 million farms.
As for what they found when they got here, that whole independence thing, well, for many, it didn't pan out. The farmers found that they were dependent on the very companies that had promised them independence in the first place. A lot of the farmers had taken loans from railroad companies to acquire their land, and those same companies were controlling the costs of moving produce to markets. No matter how hard a farmer worked, he couldn't seem to ever catch up with the debt that he was saddled with.
Many people ended up mortgaging their houses to the railroads. About 25% of all those people who settled out in the West became tenant farmers.
In the middle of the 19th century, big railroad companies in the U.S. faced a bit of a problem. Congress had recently granted them millions of acres of public lands in the newly acquired Western Territories. But all that land didn't amount to much for the railroads without products to carry on their trains.
They needed people. They needed towns. They needed goods to transport and farmers to grow those products. They realized that they were going to have to import a brand new population. And so in the 1870s, they turned to Europeans, ideal candidates for relocation. European farmers and peasants were struggling at that very time under various forms of persecution, famine, and crushing rents.
And you're moving from that to somewhere where there suddenly is real hope and purposefulness.
This is Andy Piasecki, a student of public relations. He argues that the campaign to attract European settlers to America was one of the earliest examples of the kind of sophisticated corporate marketing efforts that we'd recognize today. Railroad companies established offices and vast networks of travel agents across Europe. They conducted a sort of market research to find out which groups would be the most likely to make the move. And Piasecki says the entire campaign was rooted in one basic message.
If you move out for the West, you become free and independent.
Across the European continent, railroad men visited agricultural fairs to distribute maps and pamphlets. Hired men masquerading as professors touted the idea that America was a farmer's paradise. Some of these so-called professors said a farmer could grow crops 9 months out of a year in America, or that Nebraska only had 1 month of winter. One even claimed that the speed of the railroads produced a magnetic effect that increased rainfall.
Nobody told them about the harshness of the climate. Nobody told them about the tornadoes. Nobody told them about the brutally tough winters. Nobody told them that in some parts of the prairie, the grass is so high that your children could actually get lost in the grass.
Now, it's not that the railroad companies were promising a walk in the park in the American West. In fact, some of them actually appealed to the Protestant work ethic of the Northern Europeans. And Piasecki found a great example of this in a publication that came from the Santa Fe Railroad.
If hard work doesn't agree with you, or you can't get on without luxuries, stay where you are. If you are susceptible to homesickness, if you do not have pluck and perseverance, stay where you are. Wealth here is won only by work.
In other words, it wasn't going to be easy.
But, you know, behind that, the message from the railroad companies is, but we're there to help you. We're there to help you in every way, if you're made of the right stuff.
In the end, the PR campaigns were a stunning success. During the 1870s and 1880s, nearly 4.5 million immigrants came to the Midwest. New settlers established almost 2 million farms.
As for what they found when they got here, that whole independence thing, well, for many, it didn't pan out. The farmers found that they were dependent on the very companies that had promised them independence in the first place. A lot of the farmers had taken loans from railroad companies to acquire their land, and those same companies were controlling the costs of moving produce to markets. No matter how hard a farmer worked, he couldn't seem to ever catch up with the debt that he was saddled with.
Many people ended up mortgaging their houses to the railroads. About 25% of all those people who settled out in the West became tenant farmers.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a recording about female professional athletes. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 1 to 7, using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
The Economist explains why professional women's sport is less popular than men's. A few hours before the men's Tour de France arrived in Paris on July the 27th, a group of women cyclists dashed up the Champs-Élysées. La Course, a one-day race organised by the people behind the Tour de France, is the latest attempt to launch a women's version of the race. Previous efforts have foundered because of a lack of interest among sponsors and the public. The difficulty of creating a women's tour illustrates a wider phenomenon, with a few exceptions. Professional women's sports is much less popular than the male equivalent. Why? If there were more sponsorship and media coverage, some say, then women's sports would be more popular. Media outlets and sponsors retort that if women's sport attracted more interest in the first place, then they would invest more time and money in it. All sides agree on what it takes to make a sport successful: a balance of consumer, media and commercial appeal. Sponsors are unwilling to finance individuals and teams that don't get good exposure, and few female athletes do. The Women's Sport and Fitness Foundation, or WSFF, reports that in 2013, women's sports received 7% of coverage and 0.2% of the total value of commercial sponsorships. This is a vicious circle. Viewers want to watch sports at the highest professional standard, and sponsors want to be associated with the best athletes. Because of the lack of sponsorship, many female athletes, even those who represent their countries, have to fit training around employment. Those who are paid usually get less than male colleagues. The Professional Golfers Association, for instance, offers $256 million in prize money. The Women's Association offers only $50 million. This inequality is echoed in pay for coaches for women's teams. Things are changing. The English women's cricket team became professional earlier this month, signing a 2-year sponsorship deal with Kia, a car maker, after winning back-to-back Ashes contests. Wimbledon, the oldest tennis tournament, started awarding women the same amount of prize money as men in 2007, and the prize money for the winner of La Course is equivalent to that for a stage winner in the Tour de France. Other sports are being leaned on to follow suit. More strikingly, the opinion of sports fans seems to be shifting. 61% of fans surveyed by the WSFF said they believe that top sportswomen were just as skillful as their male equivalents, and over half said women's sport was just as exciting to watch. This will matter more when, as seems likely, the increasing numbers of women participating in regular sport yield more potential pros. In Britain, 750,000 athletes took up team sports after the Olympics. 500,000 of them were women. More female participants and viewers should encourage sponsors and the media to balance their coverage. Until then, athletes could consider taking a leaf out of Marie Marvink's book. The Economist explains why professional women's sport is less popular than men's. A few hours before the men's Tour de France arrived in Paris on July the 27th, a group of women cyclists dashed up the Champs-Élysées. La Course, a one-day race organised by the people behind the Tour de France, is the latest attempt to launch a women's version of the race. Previous efforts have foundered because of a lack of interest among sponsors and the public. The difficulty of creating a women's tour illustrates a wider phenomenon, with a few exceptions. Professional women's sports is much less popular than the male equivalent. Why? If there were more sponsorship and media coverage, some say, then women's sports would be more popular. Media outlets and sponsors retort that if women's sport attracted more interest in the first place, then they would invest more time and money in it. All sides agree on what it takes to make a sport successful: a balance of consumer, media and commercial appeal. Sponsors are unwilling to finance individuals and teams that don't get good exposure, and few female athletes do. The Women's Sport and Fitness Foundation, or WSFF, reports that in 2013, women's sports received 7% of coverage and 0.2% of the total value of commercial sponsorships. This is a vicious circle. Viewers want to watch sports at the highest professional standard, and sponsors want to be associated with the best athletes. Because of the lack of sponsorship, many female athletes, even those who represent their countries, have to fit training around employment. Those who are paid usually get less than male colleagues. The Professional Golfers Association, for instance, offers $256 million in prize money. The Women's Association offers only $50 million. This inequality is echoed in pay for coaches for women's teams. Things are changing. The English women's cricket team became professional earlier this month, signing a two-year sponsorship deal with Kia, a car maker, after winning back-to-back Ashes contests. Wimbledon, the oldest tennis tournament, started awarding women the same amount of prize money as men in 2007, and the prize money for the winner of La Course is equivalent to that for a stage winner in the Tour de France. Other sports are being leaned on to follow suit. More strikingly, the opinion of sports fans seems to be shifting. 61% of fans surveyed by the WSFF said they believe that top sportswomen were just as skillful as their male equivalents, and over half said women's sport was just as exciting to watch. This will matter more when, as seems likely, the increasing numbers of women participating in regular sport yield more potential pros. In Britain, 750,000 athletes took up team sports after the Olympics. 500,000 of them were women. More female participants and viewers should encourage sponsors and the media to balance their coverage. Until then, athletes could consider taking a leaf out of Marie Marvink's book.
Task 3. You are going to listen to an interview with the scientist Daria Seekhous. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 8, with the sentence endings, A to K. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Eventually, there should be a scientific community of around 2,000 people working here at Austria's elite university. At the moment, there are just 160 scientists working on the campus of the former psychiatric hospital. But the institute has attracted top names from the global scientific community. Dara Seekhouse, for example, is one of the newest arrivals. She's previously researched in such prestigious institutions as Stanford and the New York University Medical Center. But despite this impressive curriculum vitae, she says she's impressed with her new posting in Lower Austria.
The faculty, the colleagues that you have here, the students, the postdocs are all tremendously creative, smart, and interactive. And that, for me, makes the work that I'm going to do, I think, more successful and will make it more fun to do.
What is the value of your work? I believe it has something to do with fruit flies.
Yes, I use the fruit fly to try to understand how cells can move through barriers. And why this is important is because cells do this during cancer spreading and when immune cells chase down infections. So we're trying to understand this process of how cells can penetrate, can push their way through something that's trying to block their way, using the fruit fly as a system to study this.
I'm not a scientist, so we always see it in terms of results. If money is spent on science, we want to see a cure for cancer. To what extent do you feel under pressure to find some useful end result of your studies?
You do it because you're excited about finding out something new. And for me, at least, I did pick an area which I thought could potentially have benefits because it motivates me and excites me. And I understand that I'm being funded by the taxpayers and they would like to see something useful as a result. The thing that taxpayers may not know or understand completely is that basic research, it's not a linear process. We are trying to find things out. We hope that we will find something that's useful. We keep knocking on doors and hoping that we'll open one that will be in a room that's really exciting. But you have to knock on a lot of doors to find that room.
Do you think part of the problem is that the media underreports scientific achievements so much? And a lot of great breakthroughs are happening in science, pretty much under the radar for the public.
I would say there are two issues. One is that science isn't covered as much as I think as a scientist it should be, because there is so much excitement, and I think conveying that to the public would let them participate more in the discovery process and the joy that occurs. But secondly, I think science journalism doesn't always report on how the scientific process works, on the amount of failure that is required to achieve success, on the amount of frustration that is required to achieve happiness. And so I think the public doesn't always understand the way in which science moves forward through sort of sideways and then finally finding the way directly ahead.
Both in the USA, but particularly here in Europe, we're entering the age of austerity. How important is it that scientific research budgets are kept intact?
When you're talking to a scientist, I'm a bit biased, but you know, if I contrast America with Austria right now, America is having severe problems with austerity, and hence they're cutting their NIH budget. And I have to say, a lot of European scientists and me, an American scientist, are going to Europe as a result. And I think that that will actually be not very good for the U.S. in the long run. I think you have to invest in the future if you want to have a good future, and science is a key aspect of doing that.
Eventually, there should be a scientific community of around 2,000 people working here at Austria's elite university. At the moment, there are just 160 scientists working on the campus of the former psychiatric hospital. But the institute has attracted top names from the global scientific community. Dara Seekhouse, for example, is one of the newest arrivals. She's previously researched in such prestigious institutions as Stanford and the New York University Medical Center. But despite this impressive curriculum vitae, she says she's impressed with her new posting in Lower Austria.
The faculty, the colleagues that you have here, the students, the postdocs are all tremendously creative, smart, and interactive. And that, for me, makes the work that I'm going to do, I think, more successful and will make it more fun to do.
What is the value of your work? I believe it has something to do with fruit flies.
Yes, I use the fruit fly to try to understand how cells can move through barriers. And why this is important is because cells do this during cancer spreading and when immune cells chase down infections. So we're trying to understand this process of how cells can penetrate, can push their way through something that's trying to block their way, using the fruit fly as a system to study this.
I'm not a scientist, so we always see it in terms of results. If money is spent on science, we want to see a cure for cancer. To what extent do you feel under pressure to find some useful end result of your studies?
You do it because you're excited about finding out something new. And for me, at least, I did pick an area which I thought could potentially have benefits because it motivates me and excites me. And I understand that I'm being funded by the taxpayers and they would like to see something useful as a result. The thing that taxpayers may not know or understand completely is that basic research, it's not a linear process. We are trying to find things out. We hope that we will find something that's useful. We keep knocking on doors and hoping that we'll open one that will be in a room that's really exciting. But you have to knock on a lot of doors to find that room.
Do you think part of the problem is that the media underreports scientific achievements so much? And a lot of great breakthroughs are happening in science, pretty much under the radar for the public.
I would say there are two issues. One is that science isn't covered as much as I think as a scientist it should be because there is so much excitement, and I think conveying that to the public would let them participate more in the discovery process and the joy that occurs. But secondly, I think science journalism doesn't always report on how the scientific process works, on the amount of failure that is required to achieve success, on the amount of frustration that is required to achieve happiness. And so I think the public doesn't always understand the way in which science moves forward through sort of sideways and then finally finding the way directly ahead.
Both in the USA, but particularly here in Europe, we're entering the age of austerity. How important is it that scientific research budgets are kept intact?
When you're talking to a scientist, I'm a bit biased, but you know, if I contrast America with Austria right now, America is having severe problems with austerity, and hence they're cutting their NIH budget. And I have to say, a lot of European scientists and me, an American scientist, are going to Europe as a result. And I think that that will actually be not very good for the U.S. in the long run. I think you have to invest in the future if you want to have a good future, and science is a key aspect of doing that.
Task 4. You are going to listen to an interview with a teacher about the effect of her new idea. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 8, with the sentence endings, A to K. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Okay, now to Shelley Spiegel-Coleman. She's an educator in California. She's actually executive director of a group called Californians Together. And that group is responsible for convincing the state of California to start awarding students the bilingual seal. Here is Shelley Spiegel-Coleman with The Big Show's Marco Werman. And the story starts in 1998 when Californians voted in favor of a measure that directed schools to ban bilingual education, to teach kids English by teaching them in English. Here goes.
What we as Californians together have been about since the passage of that initiative to really was to try and change people's perspective as well as their feelings about bilingualism and looking at it as an asset and something that should be valued and should be recognized. And so there was one school district in our state that began this initiative with something called their Bilingual Competency Award for graduating seniors to prove that they're proficient in English and another language. And we looked at that one school district, Glendale Unified, and we said, well, if we could do that statewide and get school districts across our state to honor students who have proficiency in two languages, instead of looking at them as students with deficits, we think that we could really promote this issue of bilingualism, but not only promote it, but to see it as a value to our communities and to our state and to our nation. And so it was that motivation to try and create it statewide, to really have the public look at our students as having assets and having something to contribute versus having deficiencies.
So California was the first state to get a bilingual seal. How many now?
Well, there are officially 9 states, including California, who have a formal policy for a state seal. And there are 10 other states, plus the D.C. public schools, that are in the process of developing them. So within about a year, 20 states across this nation will be recognizing students who graduate who are proficient in English and another language with a special state honor.
In Monica's story that we just heard, both students that she spoke with were very enthusiastic about learning a second language for different reasons. But in fact, we're seeing foreign language instruction drop in the U.S. It doesn't seem to be a national priority. What are the risks here of remaining a monolingual culture?
I think that is true. I think you're right. The data does show that the fewer students are taking world languages and the study in other languages has dropped. But, you know, for us, there's issues of national security. I mean, you've heard from the Department of Defense over and over again that they are lacking professionals who can deal and communicate and negotiate in countries across this nation in the language of that country. Being able to have to go through an interpreter, you lose something. Economic issues are one for us. Industries across California have said that they need bilingual applicants and that those are a priority for their hiring practices. And when asked why, they said for various reasons. They said being able to communicate with customers, being able to communicate with fellow employees for safety and efficacy in the job, and being able to reach out to new markets. And so industry saw this very specifically as an advantage. And then we know also that recently, within the last 10 years, there's been a tremendous amount of brain research as to how your brain functions, that you have much better brain function when you're able to function in two languages. You're able to multitask, you're able to see things from different perspectives, and a variety of other beneficial results of being bilingual. So we see it from a learning perspective, we see it from a national security perspective, and we definitely see it as an economic perspective. All of that, I think, brings us to being able to look.
Okay, now to Shelley Spiegel-Coleman. She's an educator in California. She's actually executive director of a group called Californians Together. And that group is responsible for convincing the state of California to start awarding students the bilingual seal. Here is Shelley Spiegel-Coleman with The Big Show's Marco Werman. And the story starts in 1998 when Californians voted in favor of a measure that directed schools to ban bilingual education, to teach kids English by teaching them in English. Here goes.
What we as Californians together have been about since the passage of that initiative to really was to try and change people's perspective as well as their feelings about bilingualism and looking at it as an asset and something that should be valued and should be recognized. And so there was one school district in our state that began this initiative with something called their Bilingual Competency Award for graduating seniors to prove that they're proficient in English and another language. And we looked at that one school district, Glendale Unified, and we said, well, if we could do that statewide and get school districts across our state to honor students who have proficiency in two languages, instead of looking at them as students with deficits, we think that we could really promote this issue of bilingualism, but not only promote it, but to see it as a value to our communities and to our state and to our nation. And so it was that motivation to try and create it statewide, to really have the public look at our students as having assets and having something to contribute versus having deficiencies.
So California was the first state to get a bilingual seal. How many now?
Well, there are officially 9 states, including California, who have a formal policy for a state seal. And there are 10 other states, plus the D.C. public schools, that are in the process of developing them. So within about a year, 20 states across this nation will be recognizing students who graduate who are proficient in English and another language with a special state honor.
In Monica's story that we just heard, both students that she spoke with were very enthusiastic about learning a second language for different reasons. But in fact, we're seeing foreign language instruction drop in the U.S. It doesn't seem to be a national priority. What are the risks here of remaining a monolingual culture?
I think that is true. I think you're right. The data does show that the fewer students are taking world languages, and the study in other languages has dropped. But, you know, for us, there's issues of national security. I mean, you've heard from the Department of Defense over and over again that they are lacking professionals who can deal and communicate and negotiate in countries across this nation in the language of that country. Being able to have to go through an interpreter, you lose something. Economic issues are one for us. Industries across California have said that they need bilingual applicants and that those are a priority for their hiring practices. And when asked why, they said for various reasons. They said being able to communicate with customers, being able to communicate with fellow employees for safety and efficacy in the job, and being able to reach out to new markets. And so industry saw this very specifically as an advantage. And then we know also that recently, within the last 10 years, there's been a tremendous amount of brain research as to how your brain functions, that you have much better brain function when you're able to function in two languages. You're able to multitask. You're able to see things from different perspectives and a variety of other beneficial results of being bilingual. So we see it from a learning perspective. We see it from a national security perspective, and we definitely see it as an economic perspective. All of that, I think, brings us to being able to look.
This is the end of the listening test.